Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Today we're going to say goodbye to a woman who has spent the past decade with the Diversity Awareness Partnership St. Louis. Executive Director Rena Hajat-Carroll is relocating to Los Angeles, leaving behind a community still struggling with issues of race, diversity, and inclusiveness, issues the partnership promotes. How far has the community come in the last decade in dealing with these issues? What work remains to be done, and how do we do it as a community? We'll ask. I welcome Rena Hajat-Carroll to our studio. Nice to see you again.
Thanks, Don, for having me.
I'm sorry it's an exit interview. We've talked a number of times over the years. Where are we right now? 10 years, it's a good point at which to look back. How are we doing as a community?
Yeah, you know, I think it's been really an interesting journey. I would say 10 years ago when I started in 2007, our community was not as comprehensive in their understanding of diversity in terms of it including not just race, but sexual orientation, gender identity, disability, religion. And I think one of the things that I as I reflect, am the most excited about is that we have broadened that definition as a community. And I think that's really, really important so that we can make sure that marginalized communities and people who are hurt by exclusivity are being recognized or being heard.
You had mentioned before we went on the air that for the most part, people have generally thought of diversity only in terms of black-white issues.
Yeah, you know, I think that was my experience early on, that we were only talking about race. And even today, when we talk about diverse candidates, we're only talking about race, right? We're not thinking about all the other dimensions and identities. But that's not to say that this community is done talking about race. We still have many, many, many more years, many more conversations, many more questions to ask about race and race relations.
You know, this community seems fairly slow on the draw in dealing with the kinds of issues you're talking about, particularly about race. It's been a longstanding issue here.
Yeah, and I would agree. You know, I think my general sentiment was after Ferguson, we would be further along in terms of our conversations, in terms of the depth of the conversations. But I say that, and I also say I think there's been tremendous progress in terms of people who were not aware of how challenged our community was with race and racism that now recognize it and are now sort of new ambassadors in this work.
Why do you think it has taken so long and that we are slow to move and slow to react and slow to change?
I think if it's particularly around race and racism, if it doesn't affect you on a daily basis and it's not in your worldview and it's not in sort of your day-to-day being, then you're not really thinking about it. You're not talking about it. And I think that it takes for you to have experiences and people point out why we have to constantly talk about this and what the inequity in this city really is.
You know, I think that was shown fairly vividly in connection with Ferguson. This has come up a number of times on this program, and that is a lot of people, a lot of the in the white community were surprised to find out all of the things that have been going on in the background in Ferguson. They had no idea of the inequities and the racial injustice. But the people in Ferguson weren't surprised. They've been living with that for a long time, as are the communities in our area.
Yeah, and that continues to be the case, right? And so I think part of our work as a community is that we have to keep this issue front and center. We can't ever get to the point of saying, well, Ferguson was exactly 3 years ago. That issue is done and over, right? Because it's not. It is a requirement, I think, if you want to make this city better, if you want to be engaged, it is your, I think it's your obligation to keep talking about issues of inequity.
Well, talk is one thing. Action is another. How do you change minds beyond the conversation?
So Diversity Awareness Partnership has been really successful in the talking piece because I really believe that people first and foremost have to come together to be able to share their perspectives and ask questions that they may never have been asked before. So right after Michael Brown's death in 2014, we started doing listen, talk, learn sessions. And I was on your show a few years ago talking about these. And we've had over 3,000 people come to listen, talk, learns to do exactly that, to listen, talk, and learn. So I think that before we can get to action and before we can get to policy change and institutional change, we have to be able to understand where people's heads are, because we may not really know why a person thinks the way they think. We don't maybe know the way they've been socialized. We don't know what their lived experience is. And the only way to do that is through communication. And I believe that has to be face-to-face communication facilitated by an expert facilitator who is a professional and who understands the nuances of this work.
Can you give me kind of an example, a broad stroke example of how these sessions work?
Yeah, absolutely. And they are open to the community. We've got a number of them left in the year, so people are welcome to come. The way the Listen, Talk, Learn sessions work is that we bring the community together. It's voluntary. We always have food and people.
That helps.
It always does. And people come together and they learn a little bit of content around unconscious bias, some demographics around race and statistics. And then what we do is we ask participants in silence to observe photos from the 1960s all the way up till today that show injustice, and we just ask people to reflect on that anonymously on a note card, and we read those reactions out loud. And I think it's really powerful because it's a visual activity, and it's a way for people to just share their thoughts anonymously, and I think that's important. And then we get the feelings of the room out. And then we move into an activity called a fishbowl activity, where people are able to talk about their lived experiences based on their race. And so we segregate the room. Black and brown people are asked to sit together and share, where white people are on the outside and they're listening to the experiences, and then we switch. And then white people talk about their experiences with race, and black and brown people just listen. And then we come together as one collective group to talk together about what we've heard, about what questions we have. And these sessions have been incredibly powerful in bringing people together and in just sharing what we experience day to day.
Who are the people who attend? Are they young, old, in between?
That's one of the things that I absolutely love about our Listen, Talk, Learns, is that they, over the last 3 years, have brought together every type of person. I will be the first to say that I will look at a room and I will pass my own judgment, because we're all human and we do it. And so I will have some sort of bias around the people that I'm looking at. And they will be shocking to me in terms of what they have to share and what their experiences are. And that comes from people who I think might be a racist or might say something racist, and they say something totally different. And that's young, that's old, that's white, black, brown, from St. Louis, not from St. Louis, from major companies in St. Louis, from nonprofits. It is really, truly a diverse group of people that we bring together.
Is there a significant portion of that group, though, that would be younger? And I ask that because I think that probably the answer to some of the questions lies with today's young people.
Not necessarily, no. Mm. So it is, again, it's a really good mix. I would say in the last year or so, it's been younger families who have kids, and they're struggling to figure out how to talk about this issue with their kids or with their parents who are of a different generation, who grew up in a different time, and they're struggling to figure out how to talk with them. So in that sense, but I wouldn't say it's necessarily people in their early 20s that are coming. I would say, again, it's just a really diverse group of people.
Are they coming from the city? Or are they coming from the county? Where are they coming from?
Yeah, from all over. So, again, some of it depends on where you work, because we've done one at Busch Stadium. We've done one at Fontbonne. We've done one, you know, at different places. And we try to be as diverse as possible in terms of where we host them. And so geography obviously matters for that.
It's been said many times on this program and elsewhere that St. Louis is not a particularly welcoming city, and that people who come from outside have difficulty fitting in and that sort of thing. Does this come into play at all in the work that you've been doing?
I think so. I think that there's truth to that. I'm from Chicago originally, and actually moved to St. Louis from Los Angeles. That's where I went to college. And I experienced a bit of that in terms of not fully being embraced, though I am incredibly honored that the community gave me the opportunity to to do the work I did over the past 10 years. But I think that that's a piece of it in terms of just generally how inclusive we are towards new people.
Yeah. It's something that should be corrected, I would assume, particularly given the kind of work that you're talking about. We have a caller who wants to get into the conversation. I'm intrigued by what he apparently wants to talk about. So let's bring him in, and then we'll continue our conversation. David joins us from Soulard. David, what's on your mind?
Thank you, Don, and good luck, and I will miss the work that your guest is doing. I think I maybe should add, as a white gay male who's lived in St. Louis for 32 years, and I'm like 60 now, actually it's 37 years, I think the focus has to continue to be on greater racial diversity in St. Louis because, you know, I may be gay, but I still get all the benefits and, you know, automatic credibility as a white male solely because of my race. So, I mean, I think it's proper for race in St. Louis to lead the way. I wanted to call, Don. I've been very concerned about the role of St. Louis public broadcasting in preserving a dominant white viewpoint that's skeptical of implicit bias and resistant to acknowledging white privilege. And just as a couple of examples, KETC and its signature program, Donnybrook, makes Alvin Reed the singular voice for Black St. Louis, a man who favored keeping the Confederate Memorial and who had no problem with the Supreme Court's rationale for gutting the Voting Rights Act a couple of years in the Shelby County case. Liberal Black columnists are excluded pointedly unless their father was the chief of St. Louis police. And I pose the question also, Don, I mean, I appreciate that since Ferguson, when nationalist attention sort of forced St. Louis to start addressing this more pointedly, the 2012 mayoral debate that KWMU moderated between Francis Slay and Lewis Reed posed no question to Mayor Slay about race relations, not one, much less brought up his role in dismantling, I think it was the 20th ward, the singularly strong Democratic ward in St. Louis. That was a mere barely 5 years ago.
David, let's get to the crux of your question. I appreciate your comments, but we have a time factor here. So if there's a specific question or direct comment you want to make, please do so.
Oh, I thought I was making them. I think you moderated that debate. Can you recall me? Why was it that there was no question to Mayor Slay about race relations in that first mayoral debate, like 2 to 3 years before Ferguson, about race relations?
Okay, well, I wish that I could remember with some specificity what all the subject matter was in that particular discussion. If it didn't come up, I'm surprised that it didn't come up because it's something that comes up everywhere, every time there's any kind of a political discussion here. I think the essence of what you're getting at is maybe that the broadcasters are not doing their job in terms of inclusiveness and in addressing the issues. Rena, what do you think?
I appreciate the caller's sentiments. I think that it is absolutely imperative for people who are attending those debates, if there's a Q&A session, for all of us to hold our folks in the media accountable around issues of race and racism. And so if questions aren't coming up, then we need to be asking, just like the caller has done, why didn't it come up? Or let me make sure that this comes up in the conversation. So I think inserting yourself in that way is key. And I would say in 2012, we were in a different place than we are now. And I think that's part of the reason St. Louis struggles so much with race and racism, because we just weren't talking about it as much as we're talking about it now. And so I think from the caller's perspective, doing what he's doing in terms of asking these questions is really, really key, and continuing to ask them in a way that is conducive to dialogue. And I think that that is really important, because these issues are not easy to talk about. They're uncomfortable. They're difficult. And so much of what Diversity Awareness Partnership does is tries to help people figure out, how do we actually dialogue about this in a way that's not combative, in a way that people aren't going to get incredibly defensive and close the conversation? Because what we want is a two-way conversation where we're, again, hearing perspectives, we're understanding people, and we're trying to make people understand us and our position.
I'll just say one thing. As I recall that event, it was a public forum, and there was an opportunity for members of the audience to ask questions as well. So not all of the blame, if that in fact were not taken up, would lie with the broadcasters, but we'll accept whatever responsibility comes our way. Have to take a break. We'll do that now. We're talking with Rena Hajat-Carroll of the Diversity Awareness Partnership here in St. Louis. She is departing at the end of the month and moving on to a new job in Los Angeles. Welcome back. Continue our conversation in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back as we continue our conversation with Rena Hajat-Carroll of the Diversity Awareness Partnership. As I mentioned earlier, she's leaving at the end of the month for a new job in Los Angeles. But Rena, I wanted to get back to something that you suggested just before the break with regard to the kind of polarization that we're so familiar with these days. There seems to be a national mood where that is basically the mood anymore. How much of an impact has that had for the last 2 years? And I'll take it back to the beginning of the political campaign, because I think that's where it all started. Mm-hmm. How much of an impact has that had on your work?
Yeah, it's had a huge impact. We have seen these conversations come up more and more in our trainings, in our educational events, where people are asking questions about how do I deal with the fact that half of my family voted for Trump and half voted for Clinton, and we're on these two different sides, and what's the language that I use? And so that, again, all goes back to this debate versus dialogue. It's how are we skilled and how are we trained in having these conversations that are so polarizing? And so absolutely, we have seen the consequences of that, the national political polarization here in St. Louis in our work.
You know, it seems to me that that people of either extreme have been emboldened by the national dialogue because they're hearing it from our leaders at so many different levels that they feel that they can say anything they want anymore.
And it's sad to me. It's so upsetting and it's disappointing because I think what this has to come down to, and this is what we talk a lot about in our work, is do we have respect for one another? And what is the discourse that we're going to agree to as citizens, as a community who, again, is supposed to love and respect one another? And so when we don't have a conversation about our basic values for humankind, then I think we enter these really unfortunate conversations where people are just so offensive and it's so intense and it's painful and it has real physical manifestations for people in terms of if they want to drive down a particular highway, if they want to attend a certain event, if they feel like their life is being feared because someone may do or say something. And we know these stories are real, right? We just have to start talking to people and they will share those very real fears with us. And so, again, I think this comes down to how have we lost this just value for people and respecting people, even if we disagree with them?
There have been so many instances just in recent weeks pointing out exactly what you say. Going back to your sessions, has this surfaced in the groups that you're talking to and that are talking to each other?
The political polarization? Yeah, absolutely. It has come up certainly has come up in schools, with the clients and the companies that we work with. And again, it all is coming back to how do we actually be inclusive with one another? So going back to what you said around action, inclusion is a verb, right? Mm-hmm. And so how do we actually behave in ways that show inclusivity for one another.
We have a note here from one of our producers who says that she has listened to a podcast recently about applying an Alcoholics Anonymous format to people addressing their own racism, describing racism as a mental health issue and an addiction. Do you have any thoughts on that? That's from Kelly Moffitt.
That's interesting.
Yeah,
and
it is.
I haven't thought about that before. I think it is absolutely worth a try. We know we have success with that model in mental health communities and with addiction and abuse. And so I would say absolutely let's try it because I think that this isn't this work is not about one solution. This work is absolutely about collaboration, and it's about figuring out what's going to work best for this particular group of people, knowing that that may not work with another group of people. So I'm all for it.
Yeah. How about your connection with law enforcement? Law enforcement is playing a big role in so many aspects of these issues. Have you been working with cops?
You know, that's a really interesting question. We were early on, again, close in 2014, closer to when Michael Brown had died. And over time, we've done work with police departments here and there. But I really think that that work is being really well done by the Anti-Defamation League, Karen Oresti and her group, and other organizations in town that have the particular curriculum to work with law enforcement. Our work is really more focused on schools. Teachers, faculty, higher ed, companies, employees in big companies and nonprofits.
Yeah. And working in schools, what are you finding amongst the young people? I keep going back to the young people because I think they're key. What are you finding?
It's interesting. The issues that young people are having are the same issues that the adults are having. So it's conversations about what is Black Lives Matter? Why isn't it All Lives Matter? It's conversations about Trump. It's conversations about the use of the N-word. So these are all issues that are stemming from their family socialization. So we're seeing the kids in the high schools deal with these issues, but then we're seeing those same kids' families in our companies saying the same exact thing.
What kind of a role does social media play in getting people to start thinking seriously about the kind of issues that we're talking about, diversity and racism and inclusiveness?
I think in some ways social media can be incredibly helpful in terms of sharing resources, in terms of sharing ideas. But other times I think it can be polarizing. And I think when we ask the question about Facebook feeds and Twitter feeds and who do you follow and who do you unfriend, typically people's response is people who think like me. I you know, it's a very common response for people to say if someone is anti this or voted this way or doesn't believe in this, then I unfriend them. And so in that way, it is helpful in affirming what you may already think. But what we often say is that if you do get into a dialogue, a heated or contentious dialogue with someone on Facebook, what we often say is take it offline and message the person and ask if you can meet for coffee or maybe a beer and have a face-to-face conversation about these issues, because we think that that's more effective than doing a back and forth in 30 characters or less.
Is there a single kind of issue or single kind of question that comes up more often than others when you have your listening sessions?
That's a really hard question because there is so much that is discussed in these Listen, Talk, Learns. You know, there are maybe not questions, but statements that are made about when is this going to change? When are people going to realize the inequity? When are people going to realize that what they say and what they do has an effect on me? And that's oftentimes from people of color. And from white people, I think the question or the thought is around it's often around realizing for the first time that they have this white privilege that your caller spoke of and not knowing what to do or where to go with that.
Mm-hmm. How do you define racism?
So racism for us and in the organization is around power, and it's around having the power to allow institutions, policies, and people to have outcomes that are inequitable.
Yeah. In the LGBT community, you had mentioned earlier that this is now getting a lot of traction, a lot of people are talking about, a lot of changes are being made. Give me some sense of what you're learning in this particular area, or have learned in the last year or two.
Well, so I'd love to answer that question from when I started. So 10 years ago, yeah. We weren't even talking really right. about sexual orientation and gender identity. And even in Diversity Awareness Partnership's mission 10 years ago, we didn't include orientation or identity. And that was something that we've done over the years and started a committee with a great group of people to say, what does our community need in terms of education and awareness? So that was, like I said, 10 years ago. And mm-hmm. I remember so vividly, we did a series of educational events where people just came and they just asked questions about sexual orientation, not so much about identity years ago, but about orientation. What does it mean? Is being gay, you know, is it a choice to be gay? And why would you be gay? And all of these different questions that now I think we're at a different point, right? I think society has changed us in terms of the level and the access to education and awareness. Policies, obviously, on the federal level have changed, have allowed us to change our thinking and given us more access and information. People are more comfortable sharing their identities and sharing who and what they are. So I think that absolutely there is a greater level of awareness, but for organizations like Promo and Metro Trans Umbrella Group and a number of other organizations in town that are doing this work, it is because of them. It is because of those organizations and the great work that they do to try to change our policies and, again, institutionalize inclusion for the LGBT community.
It's moved very, very quickly. I think that has maybe caught some people by surprise, the fact that the momentum really really shifted a couple of years ago, and it's on a very fast track right now in terms of public acceptance and understanding. The transgender thing, for instance, has just caught fire in the last 2-3 years.
Yeah, absolutely. We, years ago, were talking about transgender issues, gender identity, educating people. But I think it's changed. And I would say corporate America has a huge piece to play in that in terms of companies offering domestic partner benefits, now offering transgender benefits, really thinking through transition plans. So when an employee transitions, what do you do? What is your strategy around that? And so I think companies are playing a really big role in advancing that.
What's the big challenge ahead for this this whole broad spectrum that we're talking about, from race to disability and to issues of sexual identity?
I think the big challenge ahead is really the same that it's been for the past decade and even beyond that. It is, how do we bring people together who have different experiences and different perspectives and say, it's okay that we think differently, but let me explain to you what my life is like, and let me explain to you how I've been marginalized or how this inequity has affected me and my family and my life circumstances. And until you can understand that, we can't have any kind of change. And so the work in this community, I believe, has to be around continuing to bring people together and to share those experiences.
As I said in the introduction, I guess it is accurate after all. There have been many improvements over the years, but there's still an awful lot of work to be done.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the one of the biggest challenges that I've seen is in companies, in workplaces, for individuals who feel like they don't have any issues and feel like they're good because they may be progressive and liberal or voted a certain way, or they have a few Black people that work in their organization, or they have someone who's transgender. And I think that is really challenging, because then people don't get to share because no one thinks there's a problem, and then nothing can be done to change. Yeah.
What do you expect to find in Los Angeles in terms of environment? And I'm not talking about the heat wave.
I believe, and I am unwavering in this, every city has issues with inclusion and diversity. There is no perfect city. So I am not expecting that LA and Southern California will be void of these issues. I think the issues will be different. I think that because of the sheer numbers and the optics of the city in terms of all the different cultures and ethnicities, there is a different level of awareness. But again, and LA just celebrated, not celebrated, but Rodney King, the anniversary of Rodney King was just this summer. So it's not going to be an experience where I won't experience race and racism and homophobia and a number of these other issues. And again, I think it's inaccurate to think that any city doesn't have these issues.
You'll be doing something a little bit different in Los Angeles, correct? What's the new job?
I will. So I will be the CEO of an early childhood organization called Resources for Infant Educators. It's a departure from diversity, but a very welcomed one and a new challenge to look at how to improve early childhood.
Sounds like there'll be challenges there as well.
Absolutely.
Well, you're up to all challenges, I'm sure, Rena. Thank you so much for being with us. We wish you well in your new endeavor, and thank you so much for spending a little time with us.
Thank you for having me.
Good luck to you. Coming up, a St. Louis film festival that's got St. Louis written all over it. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.